The Gurus of How To are with me now, Alvin and Lawrence U. Bell, or also known as Accurate Building Inspectors of Brooklyn, New York. They visit us once a month to talk about various home repair and related matters and take your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a question on our comment line at WNYC.org. Follow the instructions. Please don't send me any emails because I have no access to them. I have no access to them right now, but they send them to me anyway, and I forward them to you,
because they
Larry.
Want to interact with you. You are the morning and the evening star as far as public radio New York is concerned, and they need to interact with you. Me, I'm just like, you know, the potatoes on the side.
You know. I've never thought of it that way, Lawrence.
Well, I need to lose some weight. I'm trying to be the vegetables on the side.
Well, okay. You know, that was a conversation stopper.
Speechless.
When you come here, we always have a little quiz. Who wants to read the quiz this time?
Well, I will. What is the name given to a simple mechanical principle that is in the shape of a screw that is used in window spring balance devices, meat grinders, grain elevators, irrigation systems, and hundreds of other machines that move material and substances?
Really? So this is a kind of like a basic screw.
A basic screw.
Yes, it is a basic screw.
But we're looking for the principle. Now, the hint to this one is my father loves to throw this theory out at every opportunity over the last 30 years of being on the air here.
That's true, too.
I would say at least 7 or 8 times
a
year.
And the guy who put it together, the inventor, he's one of my favorite people.
Okay, let's leave it at that before we drop any more hints. Now, this is the time not only last time you were here, we talked about air conditioning. I'm sure it'll come up again when listeners call in.
Mm-hmm.
But this is also the time of spring cleaning, of people fixing up their homes, their apartments.
That's a big thing right now. Everybody's trying to fix up their homes. What we have found that people who live in houses, it's so expensive to buy even a new house, even though the real estate has dropped a little bit. It wound up cheaper to rehabilitate what they already own and expand it in a way that makes it comfortable for them. So there's a lot of construction going out there today, and this is what we would like to address.
But part of the problem with a lot of that new construction, or actually repairs, is people don't really know what they need to get a permit for, what they're doing improperly, and what could put their home in jeopardy.
Well, can I tell you the story of a friend? Actually, Larry, you met her. She bought an apartment, and it's an apartment that's kind of like it's an extension. It's the only apartment in the building that has her roof.
Mm-hmm.
And wouldn't you know, she just moved in the beginning of this month, and when it rained, the ceiling started collapsing. It's a co-op. Is she responsible, or is the building responsible even though it's only for her apartment?
Well, that's really a legal matter, because it has to do with the leasing of the proprietary lease agreement she has with the co-op or the condo. And if that space is her space, that she's able to go onto it and everything else and utilize it, possibility she may be responsible. But if it's just a utilitarian roof to protect the building in its entirety, then usually the condo or the co-op is responsible. It depends upon what's written in that proprietary lease.
Yes, and that's really it, is if they have exclusive rights. But even if they have exclusive rights, sometimes they're still not responsible for the repair of it.
That's true, too.
So that has to be looked over.
But the thing that I find right now is that there are a lot of unscrupulous contractors out there that will tell you, oh, I'll do this, I'll do that. A lot of stuff they're not allowed to do. And also, you'll even find the licensed contractors who'll do the same thing. I'm involved in 2 or 3 matters right now where licensed contract by the Consumer Protection Agency come in and they do illegal things. And all of a sudden, the owner or the person has a violation, and all of a sudden, the guy walks away from the job. I don't get involved. And this is the things that we would like to address today.
Yes.
Along these lines, a listener, Alan Greenpoint, has written, I rent a top-floor apartment in a four-story walk-up with a black tar roof. It's brutally hot in the summer, like living under a broiler. Mm-hmm. Most of the other buildings around here have silver-painted roofs. Is this something I can do myself, and does it require a permit?
No.
No and yes. Well, in reverse order. Yes, he could do it himself. No, it doesn't require a permit. The only advice I give to you is try to clean the roof off as best as possible, sweep off the roof. And the second thing is, paint yourself to the access. In other words, right. If there's a hatch,
don't have to jump off the roof.
Right, to get to it. But, you know, you think that's so fundamental. But
it happens more often than you'd like to know.
And too many roofs, I've seen footprints across it to the hatch.
Yeah, but the other thing is, if you're going to do this aluminum paint, the best aluminum paint to use is fibrated aluminum. This is aluminum paint that is made for rooftops, and it has fiberglass embedded into the material, so it has a great longevity, and it does reflect a tremendous amount of heat from the building.
And I just want to touch on that one more thing, that on a day that I do an inspection that's 85 degrees out, I have a temperature gun. On the black roof, on the silver roof, rather, or the gray roofs, they tend to be about 80, 90, 100 degrees. The black roofs, anywhere between 140 and 170 degrees. So it does absorb a ton of heat.
There was some kind of a test that occurred while we were reading the puzzle. So I'm going to read it one more time for listeners who have called and said, I didn't get it all. What's the name given to a simple mechanical principle that's in the shape of a screw that's used in window spring balance devices, meat grinders, grain elevators, irrigating systems, and hundreds of other machines that move material and substances? So this is one of those basic things that can be applied anywhere.
Yeah, actually, when I wrote this, we had a little argument, Larry and I.
You and Larry had an argument?
We argue all the time.
Go figure.
It's part of the love-hate relationship. Anyways, I put in hundreds, but there are actually thousands of devices that use this principle.
Actually, I wanted many.
I wanted to put in millions.
Billions and billions and billions.
Well, should we take some questions from
absolutely.
Our listeners?
Okay. Yes.
George from the East Village. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello, George.
Hello, gentlemen. I've got a problem in terms of air conditioning. Mm-hmm. I've got a two-room apartment in the building that was built around 1900. One room has the two windows. The other room has no windows. What we've tried to do to cool off the one that has no windows is to get more BTUs. Then we ran into a big problem. Mold started growing all around the clothing, the furniture around the...
Yes, because you know what's happening is you're chilling the place so much that your unit is cycling on and off, and you're super chilling the air, and then all the surfaces become very cold. And that's a problem with oversized air conditioning units. That's not uncommon. It tends to make the area clammy.
Now, you've always recommended that people buy an undersized air conditioner and run it at the top rather than a big one and run it lower.
Right. Yes, because actually the whole trick in air conditioning is not only cooling the air, but it's also to dehumidify the space. And if you get one that's oversized, what will happen is the moisture that's hanging in the air there will chill and not be condensed in the inside of the air conditioning unit. If you use a unit that's undersized, it'll act both as an air conditioning unit and a dehumidifying unit. And mm-hmm. this way, you save a lot of money because the unit is smaller, mm-hmm. and also you'll feel much more comfortable at a lower relative humidity.
Yes. So, what's the solution for this person is actually to get the right size air conditioner and use fans.
Okay, George.
One question. Yes. How do I cool the other room?
Fans. Or they do make those air conditioning units with remote exhaust. So you could put a unit in there and you run almost like a dryer hose out to a window.
But also he could just take a fan and the fan will kind of pull the air into the next room.
That works very well. In fact, ceiling fans work very well in conjunction with smaller air conditioning units. The ceiling fan uses up virtually very little electricity, and the air conditioning together just moves the air around and makes it more comfortable.
Now, a lot of people have called in with answers to the quiz, so I'm going to take care of a few of them now.
All right, let's do it.
Well, maybe just one. I don't know. Maybe the first caller will have the right answer. Gary from Jersey City, what do you think it is?
I thought it was the inclined plane.
No. But thank you.
Okay, we have Ron from New Jersey.
Hello, Ron.
Hi there. I'm afraid I have the same answer, the inclined plane.
Okay.
No, that's not it.
Well, you're inclined incorrectly.
well, you have to be mean.
Thank you. Charles from Brooklyn, what do you think it is?
It's the Archimedes screw.
There you go. I knew this was going to be a hard one.
Yeah.
Not.
Oh, I love Archimedes.
Well, why didn't you think that it was the inclined plane?
because he knew.
I just remember Archimedes having that screw in Syracuse.
Okay. What do you you just remember this from school, right?
Yep.
Oh, okay.
Well, I tell you something about the Archimedes screw. It is the most ingenious device, and it is found on machines like hand screwdrivers, you know, automatically hand screwdrivers and drills and a host of things around that you don't even realize they're at. And it was invented 5,000 years ago. That's the amazing part.
I'm sorry, Alvin. The 3rd century BCE is 2,300 years ago.
No.
Yeah.
3rd century. I'm sorry.
Yeah, we go back to zero.
Not
which is
three millennia. Three.
Right. I miscounted.
I'm sorry. It's okay, but it was a long time ago. And Archimedes was very smart.
Over 2,000 years ago. But it was really...
But I know some people who remember it.
But
I'm going to put Charles on hold so that his my producer can take his address and other information.
And he'll get Save Energy, Save Money by myself and George Merlis. Great book. Save a lot of money on it.
And we thank you for calling us and congratulations for winning. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate here with the gurus of how to, Al and Larry Ubell. We're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Ruth from Putnam County. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Ruth from Putnam.
Hi. We have a wood-burning stove in our living room that we use as an adjunct to heat, to oil heat during the winter.
Mm-hmm.
And when we stop using it, inevitably there is an odor that fills the living room and, you know, some of the rest of the house, like the creosote odor.
Well, let me ask you a question. You mean when you stop using it during the winter or stop using it during...
During the summer. Yeah.
Probably what's happening is you're probably getting a little bit of reverse stack effect because how cold the house gets, like in the morning, and it's probably sucking heat down the chimney. That sometimes happens. Like I find when I try to do chimney tests in the summertime and the house is completely air-conditioned, I can't get any stack effect because the house is so cold, there's no heat to rise.
Okay.
And that can be what's going on. I do recommend that you should have this cleaned at the end of, you know, at the end of every heating season because you're probably getting a lot of creosote. And also, one of the other things that will stop it will be closing the damper once you're not using it.
That's true, too. Closing the damper, but it would be good to go in there with a vacuum cleaner, one of these industrial vacuum cleaners, and suck out all of the dirt. Because sometimes you get that musty odor from the particulate of the ashes from the stove, which migrates through the whole house. I'm sure you see in the summertime that there is more dust on the shelves and windowsills than there is in the wintertime.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but that's what I would try. I would definitely do a cleaning at the beginning of the summer because I'm sure you don't use it that much during the summer.
A cleaning of the stove as well as the chimney.
As well as the chimney, definitely, because I think the smells are probably coming from the chimney more from the stove.
That's probably true, too.
Thank you so much for calling us.
Thank you.
And we go now to Denise from Westport. Hi, Denise. You're on the air.
What's up?
Hi there. Hi, guys.
What's
great
up?
Segment. Here's the problem. I have a 17-year-old house in Westport, and on the third floor is a bathroom, which my daughter uses.
Mm-hmm.
And when she runs the toilet and turns on the faucet, the banging from, I'm assuming, pipes, it's like there's a jackhammer in my head, which is on the second level, and you can hear it basically through the house.
When she shuts off the water, she hears the banging?
She turns it on, when she flushes the toilet, say, and turns on the sink, it comes on. When she switches it off, it stops.
Let me ask you a quick question before Alvin answers this.
Okay.
How old is the sink upstairs?
I was built with the house, so it's 17 years old.
17, it's not that old.
Usually, the banging of the water hammer, as it's called, usually happens when you shut the faucet off or when you flush the toilet and the toilet bowl shuts down. What's probably happening in your plumbing system is there's no air chambers inside the piping system, or if there are air chambers, they are probably filled with water. what you'll have to do is to test that out, is to shut all the water off from the main water valve and then drain all the water out of the entire system. Open up all the faucets and let all the water drain out and leave it for about a half hour. Then shut all the valves and then turn the water main up very slowly until it refills, and that may re-energize the air chambers.
But I also think that I think she's probably having a problem with that top floor bathroom sink valve. I think there might be a loose washer in there.
That could cause banging,
which
also
is exacerbated by the toilet. I would try trying to rebuild that valve or replacing that valve assembly at that sink. The valve assemblies aren't that expensive these days. And I think that might be a way to go, because if it's just happening when that particular situation occurs, I think it's a valve situation up on the top floor. And I would do a little, you shut the valves off underneath the sink, you replace, and also make sure the valves underneath the sink are all the way open.
Okay.
Try that also.
Yeah. Okay.
And also the toilet shut off valve at the base of the toilet.
They should be wide open. The proper way is to turn them counterclockwise until they can't go no more, and then turn a quarter of a turn back, so it's not solid into the system, because otherwise it can get like atrophied into that unit. You will never be able to close it or open it.
Yes.
Thank you so much for calling us, Lorne from New Rochelle. Hi, you're on the air.
How are you, gentlemen?
Good, what's up?
I've been waiting for months to talk to you guys. I just went through purchasing a 1931 house with all the requisite problems, and now I have an attic issue. Very, very hot. I tried to do a ventilation system up there, but I only have, you know, the ducts on the sides of the roof line with two ducts at the top.
You mean two vents? Two vents.
That's all I have. It's not working. So I'm wondering, do I put in a fan in the attic as well as air conditioning in the attic?
Well,
and I was wondering.
But what I would do, I would put in one of those mushroom fans on the backside of the roof, so you can't see it from the street.
Well, I have a slate roof, so it's going to be really expensive to do that.
Yeah, okay. Never mind on that one.
Yeah, well, actually, even if it is a slate roof, you can get a roofer to come in
and carve out
and get that roof ventilated.
But what I would try is that you have two vents at either side. On one side, I would actually, just for trying out, get an inexpensive fan and hang it in front of the vent and have it turn on and see if that actually works. If that, then we'll put something in a little more permanent.
What about the vents that go on the side of the house instead of on the roof?
Well, you said you already have two vents on the sides, right?
No, they're just openings. You know, they're the kind of things that stick up on the roof and the air comes in, but they're nothing.
The scoops that are
scoops.
Good old-fashioned scoops.
They don't work that well, but they work better.
But you know what's another thing? Do you have openings at the lower end, at the eaves?
Essentially, that's what they are. I've got two openings on each eave. But it's still very, very hot up there. And
You're going to have to get someone in there to actually do a look-see about what's going on, because you do need to put some ventilation. Yes, Alvin's right. You could put a mushroom fan on the back and have them flash it in properly to the slate. But you really want someone who actually – I mean, us doing it over the phone is a little difficult.
Yes. Thank you so much for your call.
But you need to ventilate those attics to get not only the heat out but also the moisture out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, along these lines, another air conditioning question. Yardena, I guess it is, in Bridgewater writes, I work in a commercial kitchen with a wall AC that doesn't work. I've been told that it's simply not possible to cool a commercial kitchen. Is that true?
No, it's not. It is not true that you can't. You can cool.
You can cool anything.
You can cool anything.
If you're willing to crank it up high enough.
Well, put the right sized unit in there.
First of all, what you have to do is most important in a kitchen area is it has to have ventilation from all the areas that you're cooking. In other words, you have to have some sort of ventilation just to take out the immediate heat that's coming off of the frying pans, the pots, the pans, the moisture, and everything else. And then they could air condition the unit, but it has to be sized out by an HVAC engineer that figures out the amount of BTUs that are loaded into the kitchen, and also how many workers are working in that kitchen.
And also how many CFMs of air are being removed from the space at the same time.
Right.
So it is a rough calculation. It's not something easy, but it can be done.
Along these lines, you inform me that no air conditioning units can be installed in a fire escape window.
That's right. You can't. Fire escape windows are special windows for you to escape from. And if you have an air conditioning unit in, you will trip over it. You won't be able to get out of the house in case there's a fire. But also another thing, usually the air conditioning system sticks out onto the fire escape, and somebody coming down that fire escape during a fire could trip over that. So that's a dangerous thing. There's a whole host of things that people should understand. You know, one of the things that people do, they move into an apartment and they start building a partition inside their heart to make another room or to make something. That's a no-no. You can't do that? Not in the city of New York. You cannot move or adjust or even cut a hole in a existing partition in anybody's home, whether it be a single-family house or a multiple dwelling.
Now, have you bought this place yourself? Have you owned it?
Well, actually, I come up with an analogy. When you buy a home or a house or anything in the city of New York, you really don't own that house. The city owns it. The taxes you pay is the rent. That's really the way it
works. And then hopefully you get to profit on the exchange of it when you rent it to somebody else.
That's right. But that's the way it works. But the purpose of that code, not to permit lay people to start moving things around. You don't know what's in that wall. You don't know whether the wall is a bearing wall. You don't know whether there's electricity in that wall. You don't know whether there's plumbing in that wall. You don't know what's in the wall or what the wall does other than divide a space from another space. So therefore, they had to enact that law. There are even provisions that if somebody wanted to change the direction of a swing of a door at the front entrance to a house, that's requires sometimes an engineer and an application because you're not even allowed to do that. Because they see from history that people get hurt. Not only do they hurt themselves, but they hurt others, innocent bystanders. And these laws are intended to protect you and everyone else around us.
Mm-hmm. My guests are the gurus of how to, Alvin and Lawrence Ubell, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Please don't send any emails because I have no access to my email during the time I'm on the air. Mm-hmm. We'll be back with more after this. We're back with the gurus of how to, Alan Larry Bell, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. I mentioned a leaky roof, and I think Charles from Brooklyn has another leaky roof problem. Hi, Charles.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
What's up?
I'd like to know about spray polyurethane foam roofing, if it's good for re-roofing New York buildings. Hello?
Yeah, I know. I'm thinking. That's the sound of me thinking.
Sorry.
Yes. The thing about the spray polyurethane foam is actually it's very good, but the manufacturer has to be involved in the application. It actually is pretty good, but they have to be completely involved in it, and you have to use their certified installers because they give it a pretty good warranty, but they'll only warranty it if their people install it. But from everything I've understood and from what I've learned about the material, it's supposed to be pretty good and it's supposed to hold up very well. But the application is very tedious or has to be the specifications have to be adhered to strictly.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard very good things about it.
Okay, next we go to Steve from Brooklyn.
Hi. I wonder if you could share your opinion. I'd love to hear your opinion on devices that go in rain gutters that let the water in but keep the leaves out.
It depends upon how much leaves. If you're in the middle of a place where it has these large leaves, you know, like maple leaves and things like that, they work very well. But if you're in a place where they have evergreens, where they have needles or pine trees, those pine needles get stuck inside of that diverter, and it clogs up with all kinds of garbage, and eventually the water just goes right over the top of it, and it doesn't catch the water in the proper manner.
That's exactly true. I mean, what happens is those are kind of gutters that have the configuration of the gutter where the leaves are big, it actually is pretty effective. But where you have small, like ginkgos and pines and tiny little, you know, and all the flowering buds from different tree flowers, that stuff tends to clog up the gutter itself, and you still have to clean it out.
And it sounds like it makes matters worse.
It does, because sometimes you have to almost remove those devices in order to get to the garbage that is underneath the devices.
Alicia from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi.
What's
how
up?
Are you?
What's up?
Okay. I wanted to put some compact fluorescents outdoors, mm-hmm. and also in my bathroom where there's a shower, mm-hmm. over the vanity. And I've been hearing that they don't hold up too well under those circumstances, because the cold will make the bulb conk out, so it will have a very short life. And the humidity from a shower would also do that.
That's not totally true, because I use fluorescent lights on the outside of my home.
I'm talking compact fluorescent.
Yeah, the compact fluorescent bulbs on my home in three locations, in the front, the back, and the side. And I have no problem with them. But I do realize the devices that I have where the bulb is screwed into it is an encapsulated container light. It has a glass lens on it where when the transformer gets energized from the electricity, when the switch is turned on, that transformer gives off a little bit of heat, and it keeps that container warm so that the fluorescent light functions properly. If the bulb itself is exposed to the elements, it probably would not work very well.
I just bought a fixture. It's enclosed on all sides except the bottom, so you could take the bulb out without having to take off the globe.
No, that's not the type. That will not
work. That won't work.
That won't work.
But
yeah.
But can I get in here a second?
No, you can't.
1 second. But I think they do make compact fluorescents, which are designed for hostile environments, for exterior and for damp areas.
You wouldn't happen to know which ones they would be, who would make them?
No, I would actually have to go to the home center and look them and read every one.
Okay, because yeah. I've also been to the home centers, and I haven't had any luck.
Yeah,
okay.
But the one that I happen to have is where the lens actually is like almost like a big bottle that gets screwed into the light fixture after you insert the bulb. So it's an encapsulated mm-hmm. kind of a container where the heat keeps the heat.
Okay.
Thank you so much for calling us, Alicia. And Jane from Manhattan, hi, you're on the air.
What's up, James?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just worry endlessly, and I've harassed my poor super about a problem. And I like the super very much, and he mm-hmm. says not to worry, and the electrician said not to worry.
So what's the problem?
But I just do. They took down a wire in our hallway that used to be in a metal raceway, mm-hmm. and they're putting it in a pipe because they're redecorating the hall, mm-hmm. and they're going to put the pipe along the wall and then cover it up sort of partially with molding. And I just wondered, is that okay?
Yeah,
absolutely. That's called EMT, electrical metal
conduit.
It's a big wire. It comes from the Con Edison panel into the apartment. I think it's 50 amps or something.
Well, that's perfectly all right.
Is it?
It's mm-hmm. perfectly all right. And usually they put some casing molding or cornice molding right over it, and it disappears.
Well, it's going to be wooden molding.
Yeah,
but as long as there's metal behind it. As long as it's through a metal conduit, we're fine.
Thank you so much for your call. And we go now to Sarah from Brooklyn. Hi, Sarah. You're on the air.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
What's
Hi, guys.
Up? What's up?
Hi.
Okay, here it is. I own a brownstone in Brooklyn. And on the parlor floor, I have an existing kitchen and powder room mm-hmm. that I want to completely rip out and put in new. Of mm-hmm. each.
Yeah.
And then on the third floor, I have an existing sort of galley kitchen that I'm turning into a laundry room. So I'm ripping them all out, basically gutting them. And I spoke to a contractor, and he said that I did not need a permit. And I just wanted to check that that's indeed the case.
Well, If he's not touching, first of all, if he's moving electrical wiring or making, putting in new plumbing and relocating stuff, he needs a licensed plumber that can file a separate certificate to do plumbing work. But
okay.
The plumber has to file a special certificate if he's doing special plumbing work. And the electrician also has to file a special certificate if he is using rewiring a big portion of the house. It depends upon how much.
But you're saying she doesn't have to get a permit unless she knocks down a wall.
Yes.
Right.
In other words,
from the building department, I don't need to get a permit.
Yeah.
Well, here's the thing. You need to, if you're not moving walls and you're not really moving fixtures, then you're okay. But the plumber, the thing is that the contract is trying to get away of not having to pay for a licensed plumber or a licensed electrician so he could realize more of the... you know, the money.
The profit.
And the profits on it. And by hiring a licensed electrician, he's going to be paying more. But if you're going to have a bathroom or this laundry area reconfigured from a powder room, that does require a plumbing application. And that is not the whole thing of having to get an architect and file. But he does have to file that application or that ticket.
You may even have to file an application to show the buildings department where you're putting this bathroom and whether they have the appropriate amount of ventilation or a window to that.
No, she's converting a bathroom to a laundry area.
The plumbing's already there.
Right. So I would definitely insist on having a licensed plumber do the work.
We thank you so much for your call. My guests are the gurus of How To, Al and Larry Ubell. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. We're kind of running out of time. Marcia in Bedminster, New Jersey, wonders, how do you clean between the glass plates on the oven door without disassembling the whole unit? I've tried squirting water through the heat vents, but that just made it worse.
Yeah,
you have to take it apart.
You have to take the whole door apart.
Yes.
There's no other way.
I've done that in my own kitchen. I have to take the door apart.
Yes.
Okay, well, that's not the answer you wanted, but what the heck. Joel from the Bronx, how you're on the air.
Hi, Joel. Joel?
Joel! We lost him.
No, for some reason, it's not coming on.
11-story pre-war building.
Joel, are you there?
Yeah, Joel, say it again.
Yeah, go ahead. Start again.
Okay, I live in a pre-war building, 11 stories high, in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Normally, we have hot water on demand. But when the super turns the hot water off to do a repair, say, down the boiler room or whatever, and turns it back on, hot water on demand disappears and becomes, you got to wait 2 minutes or so for the hot water to come back. And it gets back down to cold within a couple of minutes. By magic, a couple of weeks later, it normalizes, goes back to hot water on demand. The super says, I don't do nothing. I turn the valve on. I turn the valve off.
All right,
what do you want from me?
I'll tell you, on a building that you just described, it needs what is known as a gravity circulator system on the hot water line. In other words, theoretically, the hot water is made in the basement, and it goes up to the top floor first and then feeds downward to all the fixtures throughout the structure. Either it works on gravity if it was a gravity system to begin with, but if it doesn't, it may need a circulator pump in order to pump that water around continuously, and therefore everybody would have hot water immediately upon opening up that faucet.
But you know what I think is happening? I think they do have a pump, but I think they also have a thermostat connected to that pump, and when he turns it off for a while, the heat demand is met on the thermostat and tells the pump to shut off, and it takes a while for the system to equalize itself. That's what I think. So he says, I don't know, it happens, it works, I don't do anything. I think that what's happening is there might be a thermostat on that, and the thermostat really doesn't need to be there, but they are doing that to try to save energy in some way, and I think that's what's happened. That's my experience.
The thermostat is on the return side.
Right.
It's not on the upside. It's
right,
on the
return
side.
Correct.
Peter in Kensington asks, I live in a 100-plus-year-old Victorian frame house in Brooklyn. My father tore down the asphalt siding and has been painting the original cedar siding for 30 years. He wants to re-side the house, and I'm trying to get him away from vinyl or aluminum siding. Could you please discuss cement fiber siding or a more aesthetic and durable option?
Well, I'm not a big fan of the what he just called the cement fiber siding, which is known as EIFS or EIFIS, which is exterior insulating finishing system, because it tends to trap the water underneath the material and causes more problems. As far as not wanting to do vinyl and aluminum, those are the two more common ones. And the other option is to just do a natural material. There's really
like, you can get wood shingles again.
But then they're back in the same place. They don't want to paint. They don't want to paint.
Well, right now they're making a clapboard that has a vinyl covering, a vinyl finish on it that lasts for could last almost for 50 years.
Yeah, and I know there's also hardy plank, but I'm not a big, you know, that's also kind of a siding type of material.
So what would you use?
I'm not sure. I'd have to see the building. I really can't answer.
You don't want to louse up the architectural ambiance of a vintage structure.
Yeah, so that's kind of a hard one. That one they might want to, because I'd like to see what the building actually looks like.
Now, if you're in one of those areas where, you know, which is historically redistricted, can you just do that sort of thing without getting the okay from the city?
Oh, you have to get, that's the landmarks commission.
The answer is no. Okay. That's the simple answer.
Okay, let's take another call. Richard from Jamaica Hills, how you're on the air.
What's going on?
Hi. I live on a hill, and my neighbor's house, which is next to mine, higher up on the hill, there was a retaining wall between his property and mine. It was about 3 or 4 feet high, and it fell down, and he's replaced it. And the one that he's put up is about 12 feet high, and I was wondering whether there were any regulations that limited that height.
Well,
let me ask you a question. I need to ask a quick question. Is it 12 feet high from the base on your side, or is it 12 feet high from the base on his side?
On my side.
So how high is it from the base on his side?
Probably about 9 feet.
You might want to check the local local code, but generally speaking, you're allowed to go up at least 6 feet on a fence, so it would count from his side, not from your side, since your side is a retaining wall and not a fence.
But it depends upon where that wall was built and everything else. But if it's a massive wall, it may have required a building permit, depending upon how it was made.
It could. So you might want to check the local codes as far as how high a wall or fence is allowed to be.
And these codes are local to what, the borough?
Well, where are you?
Queens.
In Queens.
That would be the city of New York. I'd have to look it up, but there is some regulations on the construction, height and width and thicknesses of retaining walls.
But one of the things I would also check is you could check the profile on your building and the building next door and see if any recent applications have been filed for this type of work. And see what and trace it down that way.
Would he have had to have gotten a permit?
Well, he probably right now the city is on a big program to examine all of the retaining walls throughout the city of New York, because we've had some major collapses throughout the city, and they want to avoid that. The same thing has happened on the West Side Drive.
I have something very important to say. You're going to be back on June 9th.
Mm-hmm.
And meanwhile, if people want to send messages, send them to larry@ubell.com. And put a phone number in. And that's it.
And also they can follow me on Twitter at Larry Ubell, where we will.
And we can go off and
fix.
We actually are not going to even talk about that, because we got to talk about tomorrow's show, where Willie Nelson is going to be here, one of America's most enduring singer-songwriters. He'll stop by to talk about his latest CD. It's appropriately called Country Music. And then we'll explore the Chinese experience of the American Gold Rush. Also, the very funny Damon Wayans talks about his first novel called Red Hats, and our latest underreported segments. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Josh Bell and Adam Delahanty. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. We'll see you back here at noon tomorrow. And now you can say it, fellas. We're going to go forth and fix.
Save energy, money, and
do it safely.